From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ted Koppel leaves Nightline next Tuesday after 26 years anchoring ABC's late-night news program. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Koppel. Also, we talk with Neil Patrick Harris. He played the brilliant teenage doctor in Doogie Howser, and now he stars in the CBS sitcom How I Met Your Mother. A lesser-known part of his career, he's performed in a couple of Stephen Sondheim musicals. We'll hear him sing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Next Tuesday, Ted Koppel signs off as the anchor of Nightline. He began the show in March 1980 after having already anchored that late-night spot for several months when it was called America Held Hostage and was devoted to coverage of the Iranian hostage crisis. Count me as one of the many people really sorry to see him leave the show. I've often stayed up later than I should to learn about the latest crisis and to learn from and admire how Koppel handled tough interviews. Ted Koppel, welcome back to Fresh Air. So why are you leaving Nightline now? I mean, was it a really difficult decision to make about, like, should I leave? Should I stay? Should I leave right now? Should I put it off another year?
No, because my contract is up in a few days. So this is something I began thinking about really a long time ago. And in fact, my executive producer, who is a very dear and close friend of mine and with whom I will continue working after I leave ABC, he and I went to see our bosses 5 years ago and said, look, it's time to begin preparing for the transition. Frankly, I think 5 years is a long time to transition out, but we've been doing it for 5 years.
I'm going to give you the chance to answer a question that I don't think you're going to answer, which is, what are you going to do next? So here's your chance to make news on our show and tell us first. And then,
God, what a temptation. I am literally holding myself back here, Terry, from wanting to blurt it all out. Mm-hmm. But I think I have just enough self-discipline left that I won't.
Okay. Within the period of about a year, Tom Brokaw retired. Dan Rather was basically forced out. Peter Jennings died. And now you're leaving Nightline. So everyone is calling this the end of an era. Does it feel that way to you?
Well, you know, it may well be the end of an era. We are all of the same age. Peter was a couple of years older than I. He and I had been friends for 41 years. We used to joke between the two of us we had put in 83 years at ABC. Tom Brokaw and I have known each other a long time. We're born literally 2 days apart. So I think it's reasonable that it's not reasonable that Peter died at such a young age, but I think it's reasonable that as a generation of broadcasters, that we are sort of moving out of one phase and moving into another. And that is not in and of itself a bad thing. There will always be. I mean, I remember when Peter and Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw came in as anchors, there was a great deal of tearing of hair and chest thumping and people saying, well, you know, Brokaw is no Jack Chancellor, and, Rather is no Walter Cronkite, and Peter actually was just replacing himself and two other guys who had been on the program, Frank Reynolds and Max Robinson. But the sense at that time was, well, we've come to the end of an era, and we had, and it was the beginning of a new era, and a fairly good one.
Do you think that the networks want to use this as an opportunity to rethink what they want their evening news coverage to look like? And do you have a sense of, if so, do you have a sense of what that might be?
Well, Les Moonves, who controls that part of Viacom, which controls CBS, has made it abundantly clear that he thinks it's time to put an end to the Voice of God anchorman image. I'm assuming he was joking, but he has joked that he had seen in some European country a newscast in which an attractive young anchor woman gradually disrobed as she was doing the news. I would like to believe that even if he could do that on American network television, he wouldn't, but I'm not altogether sure. Maybe he would. Do I think that there are forces out there that want to drastically change the way that network news has been in the past? Forget about what I think. The people who are in a position to do it are saying it.
Nightline is getting a new look, and we've seen a preview of that already, because it's going to become a several segment program, and there's already been a couple of nights a week when it's been that. Do you regret the change from a single format show, a single subject show, to a show with several shorter pieces with different subjects?
I don't know. I know that we tried it back in the early 80s. The news division and the network decided they wanted Nightline to go to an hour. I think it was motivated more by the sense that they could sell twice as much advertising in an hour than it was by any sense that it would make a better program. But we tried it. We did it for a little less than a year, and it was a disaster. Now, clearly, I didn't know how to do it. Maybe the new guys do. I think that there are, or certainly there is, an abundance of television programming, news programming out there that has several topics on in each program. We call them magazine shows or evening newscasts. The thing that made Nightline unique for a while is precisely the fact that we only did one subject a night. That certainly doesn't mean that that's the only way of doing it or the only way of being successful. In fact, it may be that the age of doing that is destined to be over now and that they're going to try something new. I'm not about to judge it until I've watched it for about 3 months, and then if I like it, I'll say so, and if I don't, I'll say so.
How did you learn to do the long-form interviews that you've done on Nightline? Is that something that you learned basically on the air? And you know, because I'm thinking that kind of interview is different than the type of interview you would have done as a reporter, knowing that you would just be choosing, you know, quotes from that to use.
I mean, you're right. It's a different discipline. If you can do an hour's interview and then cut out the best 3 minutes, in some respects, that's a lot easier than saying we have 8 minutes for the interview, but that's all you've got is 8 minutes. And when the clock starts, you have 7 minutes and 59 seconds to finish that interview, and whatever you don't get in those 8 minutes, you won't get. I didn't find it that difficult to do. I mean, basically, you can't afford to be as polite as you're being to me right now when I ramble on. You have to, every once in a while, sort of jump in and say, with all due respect, you're not answering my question, and let's take another crack at it.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I want to play, I mean, I've always just really admired your mix of respect for your guests, but unwillingness to settle for evasion or spin. And I'd like to talk with you about that. And I thought we could start by playing a fairly recent interview from September 1st of this year with Michael Brown, who then was the head of FEMA. And this was basically the day that he recognized the problems at the convention center in New Orleans. And you express your amazement that he's been telling reporters that he'd found out earlier that day about the problems at the convention center. And you say to him, don't you guys watch television? Don't you guys listen to the radio? Our reporters have been talking about this for more than just today. And I want to play an excerpt from this interview that you did with Michael Brown.
Mr. Brown, forgive me, because I can't imagine what it must be like to have the burden on my shoulders that you have on yours right now. But here we are, essentially 5 days after the storm hit, and you're talking about what's going to happen in the next couple of days. You guys do war games. You have gamed out what is going to happen. In recent months, after a Force 3 or a Force 4 or a Force 5 hurricane, to say, as the president did, well, we didn't know the dams were going to break, or we didn't know that the levees were going to break, is factually true. Of course, you didn't know it, but you could have assumed it. You could have made preparations for what would happen in the event that you knew it was going to be a Force 5 storm that was going to hit in that region. Why didn't you?
Ted, we had people pre-positioned to move in immediately. And what happened, which is unusual in this disaster, there's two things. First and foremost, the disaster continued long after Hurricane Katrina had moved. Make sure we take care of those people. And I just want to say to the American public that they do need to understand exactly how catastrophic this disaster is. And they do need to know that we're going to have every available resource to do everything that we can. We're going to take care of these victims. We're going to make it right. We're going to make absolutely certain that the devastation that has been reaped upon these people is taken care of and that we get their lives back in order.
Mr. Brown, some of these people are dead. They're beyond your help. Some of these people have died because they needed insulin and they couldn't get it. Some of the people died because they were in hospitals and they couldn't get the assistance that they needed.
That's Ted Koppel on Nightline interviewing Michael Brown, who was then the head of FEMA when this was recorded September 1st of this year. first of all, I want to mention that in that interview, you start with, in the part we heard, you start by saying, "Forgive me, but." Is that something that you think is helpful in what is going to be a fairly combative interview like this? Kind of expressing your understanding that this is going to hurt, but I'm going to ask you this question.
It wasn't just expressing an understanding that this is going to hurt. It was expressing an understanding that he had at that time a far more difficult job than I. He, after all, has the burden of responsibility here, and it's easy for those of us who just sit on the sidelines and carp about what officials are doing to criticize, because we don't bear that responsibility. So when I say forgive me, and when I followed up by saying, you know, I can't imagine what it must be like to bear that responsibility, I really mean that. Having said that, he does bear the responsibility, and therefore he must be held to account when he doesn't perform his job well. This isn't a question. I mean, when I'm sitting there interviewing someone, and I suspect, Terry, it's the same with you when you're interviewing someone, you don't represent Terry Gross, and I don't represent Ted Koppel. You represent the entire radio audience of your broadcast, and I represent the entire television audience that's watching my broadcast. And they tend to sit there, either watching or listening, as the case may be. And to begin with, I think they identify with the interviewer, with you and with me. And they say, okay, go ahead and do your thing. And if you ask the right questions, they will continue to identify with you. If you become too combative or too rude too quickly, they will lose their sympathy for you, and they will transfer their sympathy to the person being interviewed. So it's always a bit of a balancing act to wait for the right moment to say, you know, I've asked you that question twice now, and it's possible you misunderstood me the first time. I'm pretty sure you got it the second time. So you're dodging my question. You're not giving the answer. Because at that point, I think the audience at home is saying, come on, Terry, get in there. Or come on, Ted, get in there. The guy's not answering your question. That's our job. That's what we're supposed to be doing.
Now, in this interview, that excerpt that we heard, you know, Michael Brown says to you that he hopes that they can help people get their lives back in order. And you say, Mr. Brown, some of these people are dead. And I was just wondering, like, what was going through your mind during that point of, like, how are you going to answer what he just said?
What was going through my mind is that we had just seen, I forget whether it was a piece by John Donvan or Chris Bury, but both of my colleagues were down there in New Orleans at the time, and both of them had done very powerful pieces. I think it was Chris who had done the piece at the convention center, showing bodies lying outside the convention center, showing these people who have been waiting for days for proper food, for toilet facilities, for water, for some kind of assistance to get them out of that place, and not getting it. And here is this man now telling me, well, I just found out about it today. How was that possible?
My guest is Ted Koppel. He signs off as the anchor of Nightline on Tuesday. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ted Koppel, and Tuesday night is his final Nightline broadcast. My next question comes as a viewer and as an interviewer. I'm wondering if your sense of etiquette as an interviewer has changed over the years. When you're interviewing somebody in a position of power who is just evading your answers and not, you know, not giving the information that you feel you want and that you feel your viewers should have. And, you know, I was leafing through the book that you wrote, several years ago called Nightline History in the Making and the Making of Television. And, for instance, you have an interview in there with Evan Meacham, who was the governor of Arizona during in 1987 when you recorded this interview with him. And he wasn't answering your questions. And at some point he says to you, we've been spent so much time on this one issue. And then you say to him, you have spent so much time evading. If you just answer the question a little more directly, Governor, then we could have gotten through this in about a minute or two. And then later on, you say to him, if you're not going to answer my question, at least be forthright enough to say, Ted, I'm not going to answer your question. Did you always feel comfortable being that forthright when you felt that somebody had pushed too far in evading?
Yes, for the reasons I explained to you before. It's not just Ted doing the interview any more than it's just like, you know, that it's just Terry doing the interview. You're doing it in behalf of your listeners. I was doing it in behalf of my viewers. They have a right to a straightforward answer to the question. Otherwise, why bother tuning in? If all you want is a press release from the governor's office of Arizona, you can probably write to them and they'll send you one every day.
What do you think is the most respectful way of saying that to someone?
I think there are 100 respectful ways of saying that. And I think you have to become a little bit edgier and a little sharper the more often they evade your question. Sometimes people aren't evading a question. They simply didn't get the question the first time around. And I think you have to make allowances for that. But by the second or third time, it's quite clear that they have decided not to answer you. I frankly think it's a lot easier, and if I were advising people in that business how to deal with folks like me, I'd just say, look, I'm not going to answer that question for reasons that you may or may not understand, but if you do, great. If you don't, too bad.
We're talking about people who are evasive. Can you think of one of the most surprising things you were told that you didn't expect to be told by somebody in office?
I was in Moscow a number of years ago, and the then foreign minister had agreed to an interview, and the president at the time was I believe Boris Yeltsin. No, I guess it was still Gorbachev. And well, I went in to do the interview, and before we had actually sat down, the foreign minister was walking me around his office and showing me pictures of his family. And then at one point he turned to me, sort of looking stunned, and said, Gorbachev just fired me. And I said, really? Thinking that this was prelude to his saying, and so you can understand I won't be able to do the interview. And I said, well, let's sit down and start talking. And he said, okay. And we started talking, and he told me all about it. And we got through the first reel of videotape, or the first cassette, and we were about to start on the second cassette, and I said, tell me something, have you informed your counterpart? Have you told Secretary of State, I think it was Jim Baker at the time? And he said, no. Do you think I should? And I said, well, I'm sure he'd like to know about it. So with the cameras rolling, he walked over to his desk, picked up the phone, told his secretary to get Secretary Baker on the phone for him, and clearly woke him up at at his ranch in Texas and said, look, Jim, you're the first one I'm telling this. Well, actually, the second. I just told Ted Koppel, but I thought you should know. I've just been fired. And then they had a little conversation, and then we went back to our interview. In some respects, that was sort of the most bizarre.
Is there a Nightline broadcast that you think had the biggest impact?
Hard to say. I think we did a week in South Africa on the subject of apartheid back in the mid-80s that had an extraordinary impact within South Africa. The South African Broadcasting Company had decided that they were going to rebroadcast our programs the next day. And while they did some editing on those programs, nevertheless, what they broadcast made headline news all over South Africa. And I think, you know, apartheid was clearly on the way out, but I think that may have hastened the process just a little bit.
I know you're going to be going on to other projects, and I don't know whether that's going to be daily journalism or weekly or you know, long-form documentaries or some of all of the above. But I imagine there will at least be, maybe I'm wrong, a short period of time in which you're not on the air every week.
That's true.
Okay.
In fact, I'm going to take a few months off. That much I can tell you.
That sounds like a really smart idea, I have to say. Is there anything that you think you might actually miss about that more or less daily dose of adrenaline that you've been having for years and years? Yeah.
Oh, everything about it. I mean, it is. Look, I quit smoking a long time ago. I still miss it desperately. And, you know, would light up at the drop of a hat. And I get a similar kind of adrenaline rush from daily broadcasting. Of course I'm going to miss it.
So after your last Nightline broadcast, what do you think you're going to be doing 11:30 or 11:35 weekday nights? Do you think you'll be sleeping or watching the show, watching something else?
No, the good Lord has created TiVo, and there is no reason whatsoever to stay up until 11:30 at night to watch it. I can watch it over breakfast the next morning.
And that's what you'll be doing?
Oh, sure.
Well, Ted Koppel, I'm gonna miss you on Nightline. And
thank you.
Thank you so much for all you've done on Nightline. Thank you.
That's very kind of you. Thank you, Terry.
Ted Koppel's final broadcast as the anchor of Nightline is next Tuesday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from NPR member stations and from Barnes & Noble, featuring Secrets of the Widow's Son by David Shugarts, a look at the upcoming sequel to The Da Vinci Code. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Neil Patrick Harris talks with us about growing up on TV while he played a teenage doctor on Doogie Howser, and how he went from Doogie to a role in Stephen Sondheim's revenge musical, Sweeney Todd. He's now starring in the CBS sitcom How I Met Your Mother. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Neil Patrick Harris has the distinction of having started his career playing one of the more preposterous characters on TV, a brilliant and lovable teenage doctor named Doogie Howser. Doogie Howser, M.D., ran from 1989 to 93. The second season was recently released on DVD. Where do you go after playing Doogie? Harris took a surprising turn into music theater. He performed in the Stephen Sondheim revenge musical Sweeney Todd and starred in a production of Rent. He's been in several films. Probably his most memorable role was his funny cameo as himself in Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. Now Harris is back on TV in the CBS sitcom How I Met Your Mother. The show is set in the future. The framing device is that the main character, Ted, is telling his children the story of how he met their mother. The story picks up with flashbacks set in 2005, when the father and his friends were in their 20s. Harris plays the obnoxious friend Barney. Here's a scene from the series pilot. Barney is calling Ted on his cell phone.
Hey, so you know how I've always had a thing for half-Asian girls? Well, now I've got a new favorite. Lebanese girls. Lebanese girls are the new half-Asians.
Hey, you want to do something tonight?
Okay, meet me at the bar in 15 minutes and suit up!
Hey, where's your suit? Just once when I say suit up, I wish you'd put on a suit.
I did, that one time.
It was a blazer.
Neil Patrick Harris, welcome to Fresh Air. How would you describe your role on How I Met Your Mother?
I'm sort of the awful friend that you have and don't really know why you have. He's sort of the know-it-all about women, yet he doesn't really date them very much. He just sort of wants to play the field and be absolutely non-committal towards any commitment. He's the commitment-phobe, womanizing other friend. He's sort of the Larry from Three's Company.
He's a bit Jim from Taxi. Now, I thought that after Stark Raving Mad, you insisted you'd never do a TV sitcom again. Why did you change your mind?
Well, insist is a tough word. I don't know. I was interested in doing television again, having done a lot of theater in New York for the past 3 years or so. If nothing more than the financial benefits of television are much stronger than the theater at the moment. And I was looking forward to being home in Los Angeles where I live. So I looked into television, and, you know, when you do a pilot season, which is what it's called when you're just trying to get on a new show, happens every January, February, you read a lot of scripts and you see whether you're interested or not. And there were some one-hour things that were good, but then came along this bizarre little half-hour comedy. And the structure's a little bit different on the show. It's sort of like one big flashback, one big yarn told by a middle-aged Ted about his crazy 20s in 2005. And I thought that that structure was good. And then I read Barney, who was just such a crazy guy. In the pilot episode, he is insisting on playing laser tag. He always dresses in suits and ties. He's obsessed with Lebanese girls. And it just seemed so strange and funny that I went and met with the guys and was just kind of insane in the audition and ended up getting the job.
Now you're best known to many people from the role that you had when you were in your teens as Doogie Howser, but you've had a really interesting music theater career since then. You've sung three Stephen Sondheim roles. You were in Sweeney Todd, Assassins, and a musical written for television that Sondheim did called Evening Primrose. How did you get your first Sondheim role?
I was in the musical Rent. That was the first big musical thing that I did in L.A.
This wasn't the Broadway production. This is the L.A. production.
The second national tour, Michael Greif directed it in La Jolla, where he was artistic director, and then it moved to the Amundsen Theater in L.A. and played for a while. It was sort of the first leg of the tour. And some people who had seen me in Rent were doing just a concert version of Sweeney Todd at the Amundsen with Kelsey Grammer and Christine Baranski in the leads, and they thought I'd be right for Tobias, which is a role in Sweeney Todd. And so I ended up doing that, and Stephen Sondheim came to see that and thought I would be good to do another concert version of Sweeney Todd for the New York Philharmonic that Patti LuPone and George Hearn ended up starring in.
So the first Sondheim role that you sang, the first production of Sweeney Todd that you did, you had not yet met Sondheim, but subsequent to that, you did meet him, and I don't know how much of a chance you had to talk about the scores that you were singing, but did he give you any useful insights into his writing that helped you as a singer?
Steve and I became friends less through the work we were doing together and more through our mutual love of games and puzzles. He's a gamesman, and I love me some puzzles and murder mysteries and that sort of that genre, and he does too. So we started talking about computer games and crosswords, and he used to do a big thing where he'd have people come to his house, and he'd have set up this big group puzzle thing where you'd go from room to room and solve puzzles that would take you to sort of a treasure hunt, take you to a clue to another place. And I was infatuated by that idea. I think that stuff is great. And so we became friendly that way. And I think it's better to talk to someone as incredible as Stephen Sondheim about things other than his work, because I think he's probably dealing with people that tell him how great his work is and how amazing he is all the time. So I sort of tried to just talk to him about regular things that I liked, that I knew he liked as well. I'm so impressed by him in a structural way, because he writes music and writes vocal parts with very specific actors' thoughts in mind. Not just how they're going to say the words, but actual thoughts. He'll put a quarter rest instead of an eighth rest or a full bars rest because the character in his mind is taking time to think of what to say next. Or he'll repeat a stanza twice, and on the third time, the last note will raise up a third step. That's not just because he was bored, but he's actually thinking that the character on the third line is repeating to himself and then realizing something, and that realization would cause you to raise your pitch at a third. So I think, not unlike Shakespeare, he maps out what the actor should do in his mind very specifically in what he does. And there's a lot of pattern in what he writes. And if you can wrap your head around that structure and really try and decipher it, then I think he hands you a better performance.
Would you apply what you just said to a Sondheim song that you've performed?
Like Not While I'm Around, that Tobias sings, has a bunch of weird minor thirds because it's he's in thought process and sort of confused by the whole thing, repeats himself a lot. In Evening Primrose, there's a great song, If You Can Find Me, I'm Here, mm-hmm. that sort of repeats itself a lot, but has little minor changes to it that are as he's walking around, and if he's startled by something, there's a, you know, 2-bar pause while he looks around before he commences again.
I'd like to play your song from Sweeney Todd, Not While I'm Around. And your character in this, you're like the young apprentice of Mrs. Lovett, the character who bakes dead bodies into pies. And the dead bodies are the people that she and Sweeney Todd murder. And the pies become both a way of covering up the bodies and a way of selling cheap pies. And Tobias doesn't realize that Mrs. Lovett is in on these murders. So he sings her this beautiful song in the hopes that he can kind of warn her and protect her from Sweeney. Would you talk a little bit about this song and about any advice or insights that Sondheim gave you about it?
Sure. Tobias is a bit of a simpleton. You know, he was going around selling elixirs with another barber named Pirelli, and I sort of backstoried that he was beaten and abused and a little slow in the brain. Sweeney is a very vengeful, single-minded character who only wants revenge for being put in jail, and this judge who did that, he's trying to fix that wrong. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Lovett is nothing but sort of wistful and a little kooky and sort of infatuated with Sweeney's passion. So Tobias witnesses Sweeney Todd being villainous, but he's sort of too simple to really put all the pieces together. He's not an incredibly articulate person. And his love and appreciation for Mrs. Lovett just comes on a more maternal way. He just never had anyone who was taking care of him be loving. It was always sort of awful and abusive. So Steve's notes to me were just to make sure that as you're singing the Tobias parts, that it's realizations that you're having at the moment. He's not someone who has a lot of foresight or is able to look back and put pieces together. So when he's singing things, he's really coming up with the thought and the idea while he's saying them. He knows that there's something wrong in the room. He knows that Mr. Todd's probably involved and just not a good vibe, you know, because he's just a sort of young guy. and his desire to protect Mrs. Lovett doesn't come from anything that he knows, just something that he feels.
And also, this is a character who's actually kind of weak. He's not only, you know, not very bright, but he's not particularly strong. He's not particularly big. He's not particularly.
Yeah, it was originally done on.
Yeah,
it was originally done on Broadway by Ken Jennings, who is a very who's a smaller, diminutive kind of guy, and I'm 6 feet tall, so he was sort of the archetype that I had to go from. So I sort of added a bit of a limp. I twisted one of my feet in, sort of Kevin Spacey, Kaiser Soze style, and I sort of pitched my voice up a little Mandy Patinkin-ish, and sort of gave him a bit of a hobble. So, because I didn't want to be physically imposing at all. In fact, I wanted to be a bit sympathetic physically, someone who's not capable of just standing himself up and making the right choice. He has to have others sort of make choices for him. And so I needed to sort of physicalize that and vocalize that. If you hear the song, you'll hear it. My voice is very, I'm kind of pingy the whole time. It's not how I normally sing.
May I say you're also doing a little hip-hop thing with your hands? Did you notice that?
Am I hip-hop?
Yeah.
I like to keep it real. You're throw doing, a little gangster
yeah,
in there
yeah, exactly.
as well.
You're doing slightly like hip-hop hands.
Word up.
Okay. Was that intentional?
Doing yes, that? Yes. I threw a little Puff Daddy in there as well, just for the youngsters. You got to play to every demographic, right?
Okay. So let's hear you in this production of Sweeney Todd, which was shown a couple of years ago on public television. And we're also going to hear Patti LuPone in the background.
Nothing's gonna harm you, not while I'm around.
Of course not, dear, and why should it?
Nothing's gonna harm you, no, sir, not while I'm around.
What do you mean, a man?
Demons are prowling everywhere nowadays.
And so they are, dear.
I'll send them howling, I don't care. I got ways.
Of course you do. What a sweet, affectionate child it is.
No one's gonna hurt you. No one's gonna dare.
I know what Toby deserves.
Others can desert you. Not to worry. Whistle, I'll be there.
Here, have a nice bonbon.
Demons will charm you with a smile for a while. But in time, nothing can harm you. Not while I'm around.
That's Neil Patrick Harris from a production of Sweeney Todd, the Stephen Sondheim musical.
It's so strange to hear those things because I'm not really a trained vocalist, so it brings me back to standing there at the New York Philharmonic at Avery Fisher Hall at Lincoln Center with that orchestra there and frigging Patti LuPone and George Hearn and all these amazing operatic people. And I sing okay, but I've not, you know, I didn't study for 6 years with some amazing person or anything. I have a vocal coach, but having started on television and then sort of veered into theater, it was definitely one of those pinch me, I can't believe I'm here moments.
My guest is Neil Patrick Harris. He's now starring in the sitcom How I Met Your Mother. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Neil Patrick Harris. He first became known for his starring role in the sitcom Doogie Howser, M.D., playing a brilliant teenage doctor. How old were you when you auditioned for Doogie Howser, and how did you find out about the part and even consider auditioning for it?
Well, we never wanted to do TV. We, you know, I the first thing I did was a movie called Clara's Heart with Whoopi Goldberg, and that sort of came about through a gentleman named Mark Medoff, who's a playwright, and had he wrote Children of a Lesser God, and he wrote Clara's Heart. I went to a drama camp for a week at New Mexico State University, and Mark thought I'd be right to be in this movie. I ended up getting the movie and got an agent. So that's how my career started. And then we just never wanted to do television because it always would uproot us so much, you know. It was fun and fine to go away for 4 or 6 weeks to Big Bear and make a movie with Patrick Duffy and Lonnie Anderson and have a fun little summer and then go back to your regular life. But the conceit of doing a television show was just so all-encompassing. Both of my parents were attorneys, and it just seemed crazy to uproot us all. So there was one caveat. We said, well, if it's a really good TV show, if it's like a Stephen Bochco show, because my parents loved L.A. Law, being lawyers, loved Hill Street Blues, or if it's something really good like that, then we'll consider it. Well, sure enough, you know, a script comes down the pipe for a little precocious teenage doctor kid by Stephen Bochco, of all people. So we said we might as well read it, or we might as well audition for it, I guess. And so I had sort of an in. The casting director of that show knew my manager, then agent Bo Shute, very well, and so he thought, you know, he already had sort of an inner track for it. So I got to go meet Stephen Bochco really before casting had even begun. And yeah, then sure enough, months later, they hadn't cast the role yet, and I went back in and re-auditioned and got the job, and we were indeed uprooted to L.A., and that was sort of how it happened. It was strange. Not many half-hour shows were one camera by someone who was so noted for doing long-form television, like Stephen Bochco. So it was a bit of a hybrid show at the time, and it was a lot of work.
And you were, what, 14?
No, a little bit older. I filmed the pilot when I was 15, and we started the series properly when I had just turned 16. So it was about 16 to 19.
So did the producers, like, interrogate you to make sure that you could handle, you know, emotionally handle being uprooted and doing television and becoming famous? Did kind of give you some idea of how this might change your life? Because, you know, it's a big change for anybody, but for particularly like a 15-year-old, you know. So what did they do to prepare you or to test you beforehand?
Stephen Bochco did sit me and my parents down at a restaurant right when it all began and sort of said, look, this is going to be potentially a big chapter in your life and a big giant wave to ride. But he said, please know from experience that the business is not unlike sets of waves and that you can ride one and it's a great ride, but suddenly it crashes on the sand and you have to stand up and shake yourself off and swim back out, and there might be a long period of time before another set of waves come. But trust that the business is lots and lots of waves that keep coming in, and if you can wait it out and hopefully hop on another wave later on, that'll be good. But, you know, I think he was more forewarning us that this wave that we were currently on would inevitably, you know, hit the shore. And that we shouldn't be so, you know, overwhelmed by that. And that was nice to hear. It actually put things in decent perspective.
So on Doogie, you were a teenage doctor, a really kind of precocious, overly smart kid who's already a doctor in a major hospital. So of all the impossible premises that the show had in its 3-year run, what was one of the ones that struck you as particularly ridiculous?
Well, I had to do some work on my girlfriend. I had to give her sort of an exam that would, an intimate exam on a gurney hospital table that mortified her and me as well. That seems kind of shocking. I think I did surgery on a dog, a stray dog, one time. That was something else. I don't know that would happen on Scrubs. That would probably happen on Scrubs.
So who came up with the name Doogie?
That was a friend of Stephen Bochco's, was named Douglas, and his nickname was Doogie. And I think Stephen thought that was a nice way to show an adult's world but have a sort of child's name, you know, have adult responsibility but still throw in sort of the adolescent skew, and to have a name like that, to have your parents call you Doogie while you're able to prescribe medicine and doing, you know, vasectomies and whatnot, seemed like a nice juxtaposition.
My guest is Neil Patrick Harris. He's now starring in the sitcom How I Met Your Mother. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Neil Patrick Harris. He got his start starring in the sitcom Doogie Howser, M.D. Now he's on the CBS sitcom How I Met Your Mother. Was it hard after Doogie Howser to convince casting agents that you could be anybody else, that you could be somebody completely different, and that you could grow up?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's hard for anyone who's on a successful show, sort of known as a person, a specific person for a long time. It wasn't, doors weren't slammed in my face, but I was really only thought of for a specific kind of role, and mostly on television. The crossover from TV to movies wasn't as widespread as it is now, and wasn't so welcoming. If you were a TV person, you were sort of doing movies of the week in your hiatus, as opposed to a cool independent film. But that was fine. They certainly paid the bills, and I have no complaints over how that all went. I understand it. I want to direct. That's sort of my main aspiration, and I get it. You know, if I was directing a movie, a big blockbuster movie, I probably am not going to cast as the young lead a guy who was a really brainiac teenage doctor on TV for 4 years. That adds baggage that they don't. I would just assume hire someone who hasn't done much of anything before and try and make them a star. So I understand that logic, and I just kept thinking back to what Mr. Boshko said about, you know, waves will come when they will, and you just have to sort of be patient and ride them out. Theater helped a lot with that, actually. The theater, the casting directors from the theater gave me the shot to play against type. You know, Mark and Rent was very against type, and the MC in Cabaret was this very androgynous, you know, crazy polysexual guy in Weimar, Germany in the 20s, and that I would never have been thought for had that been a feature film or something. So I was sort of given the chance to expand the box and sort of spread my wings a little bit theatrically, I guess.
You had a very funny cameo as yourself in Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. And they're driving in their car looking for the White Castle, and they pick you up hitchhiking, and they recognize you. But instead of being the Doogie Howser type, you're just obsessed with, like, scoring, you know, with finding with finding girls.
I'm tripping on ecstasy and
exactly.
Need to get to a strip club. Yeah.
Yes. So, and we can't play a clip of it because the language is totally unacceptable for radio. When you were offered this part, did you immediately say yes? Or, I mean, could you tell when they offered it to you whether the joke was supposed to be on you or with you, if you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. That was the big question. I mean, I would love to separate myself and my image from the Doogie days, but at the same time, I really have incredible respect for the people that created that show. So at no time do I want to be trashing my past or making fun of the work that I've done. If not for me, for the people that spent a lot of time creating that show. So that was my worry was, great, you want to have this extreme kind of messed up version of Neil Patrick Harris. I'm down with that, but is it going to be at the expense of a bunch of bad Doogie Howser jokes and people sort of mocking that? they were sort of didn't get that. They wanted it to be more reverential than they did have it be spoofing me or picking fun at me.
So did that movie, did Harold and Kumar change your image?
I don't know. I mean, I can't determine how my image is seen, but it certainly made me not look so square.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I was playing Neil Patrick Harris, but we also made sure that in the credits that it's Neil Patrick Harris as Neil Patrick Harris, not as himself. That I was playing the part of Neil Patrick Harris, who was this sort of, you know, crazy, you know, drug-induced, horny guy. So it was great. I worked for 2 days, and that was it turned out to be a good thing. I think Harold and Kumar, that movie ended up getting me Barney and How I Met Your Mother, because without that, I don't think people would have expected me to be so extreme in that way.
Well, Neil Patrick Harris, one final question. 3 names, how come? Why not Neil
Far
Harris?
More theatrical. I am a stage actor. No. 3 names. That's my birth name, and there was another Neil Harris in the Screen Actors Guild when we were signing the papers. So we thought about being someone like Neil Danger or, you know, Neil Patrick Rocket. But we just figured the whole name would be nice for everyone involved. So it stuck.
Well, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Neil Patrick Harris stars in the CBS sitcom How I Met Your Mother. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging everyone to maintain their brain. Brain health tips at alz.org. And from members of the American Institute of Architects, working to create valuable and sustainable buildings and communities. Good design makes a difference at AIA.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Joan Didion. This week she won the National Book Award for Nonfiction for her memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking. It's about grieving for her husband, the writer John Gregory Dunn. He died suddenly in 2003. Also, a conversation with trombonist Roswell Rudd. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.